Accession number 8736, roll number 44.
Lord Harding, tape 44. You were telling me about Nico Sampson and how he ended up.
Well, when the Greek colonels decided to intervene in Cyprus in the hope of getting Ennissus and all the kudos and political kudos that were accrue to them from that, they used Nicholas Sampson as a sort of puppet, future head of state or president. And they tried to capture Makarios and put Nicholas Sampson in to take over as president. But that didn't last very long. And then the Turks intervened, and the whole situation changed, and Makarios came back, and Nicholas Sampson was disappeared, or anyway, no longer was president, because Makarios took over again. And then, I don't know why, but he was, I suppose because of what he'd done, he was put on a charge by the new Makarios government and given a sentence of imprisonment by them. So as far as I know, he is now a prisoner of the current Cyprus government. But whether he served his sentence or not, and what he'll do when he comes out, I don't know. But no, he's a bad man. A very, very bad man. On one occasion, he murdered the medical officer of the Blues, who were then stationed in Cyprus. And the medical officer of the Blues had been attending a Greek family. I don't know what the trouble was, but he'd just come from visiting and attending a Greek family, and he was on his way back to his barracks, and at a crossroads halted in a traffic block or whatever it was, and was murdered by Nicholas Sampson. Well, that's the sort of man he was. Where he is now, I don't know. Whether he's still in prison. When he was taken off after being sentenced to imprisonment by a Greek separate court, he claimed that I had some responsibility to do with it, I think, but I don't know. That was just a report. But he was typical of the pathological killers that get developed by this sort of political violent movement. And I suppose people in the Red Gang in Italy, or whatever they call it in Germany, are the same sort of kidney. They're fanatics, and their own lives are at a discount as they're prepared to put their own lives at risk, serious risk, for what they believe to be a just cause, and which is nothing more or less than a fanatical approach. And there are a few of these, not an awful lot, but Grievous was the same kidney.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Grievous. You know, yeah. Were you building up a profile of him during your experience?
Well, I think he was the same. He was a dedicated innocent and believed that anything was acceptable or admissible if it helped to advance the cause of the innocent, just as the anarchists do, and the world is suffering from, to an increasing extent, in my view.
Do you see a movement towards this sort of activity in the world today?
Well, I think there's an increase, don't you? I suppose it's all this, and I suppose that there are some form of extreme nationalism or extreme religious fanaticism is at the bottom of it all. I mean, whether they're fanatical Shiists who hijack aircraft and then hold the hostages at ransom, or whether there are people who, like the ones in Italy, who kidnap a leading politician and then murder him, I don't know. And they're extremely difficult to deal with.
You were talking about the EOCA terrorist methods. Did you have any cases of sort of poison threats of water or milk for...
Well, there was a reported an attempt to poison the milk coming into Government House. I don't know to what extent it was accurate, but it was certainly taken seriously. At the time, there was also, of course, there was a reported, it was reported that EOCA were planning to plant a sniper in the upper story of the Greek consulate, which faced the Anglican church in Nicosia, which I and my wife used to go to for services whenever we had the opportunity. And the report was that they were planning to place a sniper there who would take me off as I went up the road to church. It never came into anything. They did plant a bomb on the steps of the officers' mess of the military hospital in Nicosia, and of course they put a bomb in my bed. But those tactics, and certainly the bomb in the bed was a reality. But and the bomb under the steps of the entrance to the officers' mess in the military hospital was a reality. But fortunately for me, neither of them were effective.
Is that the case that the bomb was defective under
the bomb? The bomb under the steps of the military hospital went off. Actually, but nobody walked over it. Nobody stepped on it. The bomb in my bed didn't go off because the man who put it there, who was on the domestic staff of Government House, had made a mistake in the detonator. The EOCA at that time were using detonators that they got from either British barracks or from police stations or something. The type of detonator that had been produced and supplied to resistance movements during the Second World War. And they had two strips on them, tear off. One you tore off for a 12-hour detonation and one for a 24-hour detonation. And a chap who put the bomb in my bed made a mistake in tearing off the 24-hour detonation one. And the result was, instead of going off about midnight, it went off at midday the following day, after it had been discovered and removed. But even then it was pretty effective. It blew in all the windows in that side of Government House when it went off.
It did actually go off, did it, the bomb?
Yes.
Yes. What was anyone about when that happened?
No, well, yes, it was found in the bed, and it was taken out by the officer in command of the guard. He carried it out on a shovel and put it into an old weapon pit down by the drive running up to the house, and a minute or two after he put it in there, it went off. So he was lucky, as well as me.
What made them search for a bomb then? Where was it actually hidden? Under your bed?
Between the mattresses.
Yeah.
In the underlay.
Yes. Yeah. Was there anything suspicious, in the behaviour of your servant that made you search for the bomb?
No, I think my batman, my shoulder servant, was responsible for looking after the bedroom. My wife was next door in her sitting room, dictating letters to her secretary and working on her correspondence. And this boy, young soldier, Corporal Welch, was making the beds, I suppose, and he found this paper parcel, brown paper parcel, and didn't know what it was, and so he opened the door and looked through the door to where my wife was and said, "You late, my lady, there's a bomb in Archie's bed." And she was very busy, so she said, this is no time for a practical joke." He was rather inclined, fond of practical jokes. "Corporal Welch, this is no," but he said, "but there is, my lady." So that created the alarm, and everybody was sent for. I was out. I'd gone off early in the morning somewhere. And the deputy governor, George Sinclair, came up and decided to get my wife to get out and go outside into the garden. And she was more interested in the bomb than anything else, not having seen one before. Anyway, it was they attempted to disarm it and decided they couldn't do that, so it was carried on. And they went off outside. That was it. It's an occupational hazard.
Did you have to take great precautions about your own security there? And
well, my staff did, yes. And that really increased the... The government house staff, the domestic staff, was entirely Greek, Cypriot, up to then, and they were changed, and an army staff was introduced with cooks and waiters and so on. Oh, yes, they did that. And then I used to travel by helicopter whenever I could, rather than by road, so as to avoid any possibility of an ambush. Helicopters. They hadn't got, any anti-aircraft weaponry of any kind, so travel by helicopter was a safety one, perfectly safe and easy. Or whenever it was possible, I used to go that way, and my wife did the same. Oh, again, that's a very good use for helicopters that way. Oh no, it's a problem, but you mustn't let it stop you from doing what you ought to be doing any more than members of our devoted royal family do now.
How about cases of sabotage, looking at the methods of IOCA? Were there many examples of that?
Oh, yes, I suppose there were. They made a direct attempt to sabotage the broadcasting system, for example. They did a considerable amount of damage, but they didn't put it out of action. There were attempts at sabotage on the main power station, one of the main power stations. And then, of course, there were ambushes on the roads, and particularly in the mountain areas, some of which were unsuccessful, fortunately. One or two were successful, we had casualties. But, the general sort of tactics were... Once they had ceased attacks on the police stations, because we had then arranged after that series of events, we put a military, an army guard into the main police station, so provided against future raids that way. Well, then they turned to ambushes on the roads and so on. With They weren't so effective as they are today, for example, in Ulster, because they hadn't got the resources or the means of remote-controlled bombs or that sort of thing. But they were difficult to deal with. They caused casualties.
How about shipping? Were there any acts of sabotage towards shipping ever?
Towards what?
Shipping. You know, the ships on the supplying the island.
No, I don't think so. Oh, well, there was one of my escort commanders, a young officer in the Blues, had a yacht, which he, whatever you call it, stationed in the harbour in Kyrenia. And they put a bomb in that and blew that up. But I don't know of any other cases.
Was anyone on it at that time?
No. No, fortunately there wasn't.
How about the airports? Did they have to be very heavily
guarded? Yes, they had to be very... Yes, they were, of course, they were clear and obvious targets for sabotage. And they did... they were successful in putting a bomb into an aircraft that was due to take some families or... away from Cyprus, Somali families. But that was detected and found in time. Generally speaking, they weren't all that expert. Certainly compared with present day comparable organizations, they certainly weren't very all that efficient. Which was lucky, I suppose, for us.
Much intimidation was there in Cyprus during your 2 years?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I think a great deal. I think, for example, I'm quite sure that the young Greek who put the bomb in my bed was under severe a threat to his family. In order to get him to do it. My wife liked him. He was a young man. He used to help her with her flowers and that sort of thing, and was always very polite and helpful to her, and she thought well of him. She likes to think, as I said just now, that he tore off the wrong strip purposely. But from the what he said in the film, Granada film on Cyprus, where they had him in the program, I don't think that was true. It's very difficult to answer that question. I can't remember what I said after that.
What do you think the degree of infiltration, EOCA infiltration, was to say the government or the police? Or even, as it would appear, your servants, you know, in Government House.
Well, of course, as far as the... Going to your last point first, as far as the staff at Government House was concerned, that was certainly... there was intimidation there. I mean, I don't think that boy would have done what he did, in spite of what he said on the Granada programme. But for intimidation. As regards the police... I think there was a great deal. And I think one of the causes of the demoralization of the police was due to intimidation of the police officers, the Greek police officers, and other ranks. And no doubt when they said, I made a plan to raid a police station, on occasions there must have been inside information about it. I think that was the case. Infiltration, no. Certainly not. We would have realized that in the police, because recruitment of Greeks, once we really started really effective operations against EOCA stopped. Recruitment of Greeks to the police, then we had to rely on recruitment of Turks. And we set up a Turkish mobile police organization, which again has been the subject of criticism. But at all times, throughout my time there, and I'm quite sure subsequently, recruitment into the police was open and encouraged by both, from both communities. And there was certainly no what you now call racial distinction as far as the government or I personally were concerned. Intimidation, infiltration of the civil service, yes, possibly at the lower levels, but certainly not at the higher levels where they were mostly, not all, but mostly British. I mean, there are quite a few. For example, when I went there, the Attorney General was a Greek. And he was subjected to tremendous pressure, intimidation, and particularly as regards his wife and family, so much so that he asked to be relieved of his appointment and we sent him back to England. I believe he's since then gone back to Cyprus. So that sort of thing went on. Infiltration, I think was always a danger, and particularly, I mean, you had to be particularly careful about police communications, intercommunication between police and various sections of police and the services. But no, certainly no infiltration of the British services, none whatever, or the British elements in the police force. No, not at all, none. No, I think that about sums it up.
Taking the sort of social makeup of the Cypriots, would it have been very difficult to have pinpointed an Eoka-free area or street or household? Or was it the case that you could never really be certain who was and wasn't connected
to Eoka? I don't think you could be certain whether you were. And the net result of that was, of course, that social contacts between the services and the local population were very restricted and limited, and to a large extent between the government officials and their families and the rest of the civil population. And this, of course, was very difficult and very unhappy and very serious, because one of my senior government officials, Capital John Redway, had a Greek wife. And she was employed in the security organization. And this made it very difficult for them with Greek friends and relations and so on. No, it always creates difficulties when you have that sort of thing. But I know them both very well. Indeed, I know her particularly well. We've remained very good friends. I see her from time to time now with him. And she has always been a most loyal and devoted member of what I call the anti-Eoka community. Well, it isn't easy for them, from social point of view, or from their family's point of view. And this is, I think, the worst feature of fanatical nationalist, extreme nationalist or religious or partisan activities. To me, it's a complete anathema.
The way it divides communities.
Well, it divides communities yes, it divides families. And you've got the same thing going on now in here in the miners' strike. And to me, it's all the result of totally mistaken ideals, principles and leadership.
Did you have any problems regarding the schools?
Yes, we did. Yes, very serious problems, really. Because, as I told you earlier on, it was the British policy to keep education on a national basis. In other words, the Greeks had their schools, the Turks had their schools, and there were only one non-communal school, and that was a specially designed school, which I mentioned. And of course, the teaching in the Greek schools was very, very partisan. In fact, for some years, I think from the time of the beginning of the British administration of Cyprus, the majority of the teachers in the Greek schools came from Greece. They were Greek nationals. And in the schools there were maps and pictures of Cyprus, exactly cheek by jowl was Greece. The whole thing was entirely partisan and completely misrepresented is a mild word, the history and the situation, the way in which the children were brought up to think about it and to believe in it was completely false. And this was the result again of extreme nationalism.
Were you able to do anything about that, or did you deem it necessary?
Well, I would have liked to. What we did do, of course, we stopped student demonstrations and student rioting and that sort of thing. We were able to stop that, but we couldn't. I got out a senior officer from the Colonial Office who was top level advisor on educational problems, and he worked on the problem and advised about it, but I don't think it had any real effect. I mean, you can't, if you've got I think from my own view is this is the one of the problems that we in this country have got to face now. There is not a very high standard of professional integrity in the educational service, with respect. And I think that was certainly the case in Cyprus, very much the case in Cyprus, where nationalism, or extreme nationalism, overrode integrity in the teaching profession. And I think this happens in other places as well.